Okay, brother.
I've been sitting here thinking about all the things you do for me, how you make me feel. But wondering if it's the same for you. But when you're not around, I lose my mind, 'cause you keep it like a secret. Why won't you?
Okay, greetings, salutations, all you amazing people all over the world. Welcome to the In God You Trust program, radio show, and podcast. I'm your special guest. I'm called Man, but you can call me Kevin. And I am just here to simply share the truth, the love, and the peace that we all have for each other, as well as bringing some facts regarding a lot of interesting and exciting topics, such as private trusts, estate planning, civic law, statutory versus non-statutory law, the public versus the private jurisdictions, money, debt, and credit, negotiable instruments, legal terms, definitions, U.S. codes, and commercial competency. So we are excited today. We have a very special show for you regarding the topic of money. For some reason, I think everybody has an interest in money. It's the way the world goes around. And I just want to give you kind of a little quick background about myself, and then I'm going to bring our special guest here to share his insights in the world of cryptocurrency. So, you know, In God You Trust is a show that's dedicated towards bringing some topics that generally have been suppressed by the public system. There have been people of nobility and the elite status who have, over the centuries and thousands of years, actually created the topic or the illusion of control through money, the money system itself. My journey started about 30 years ago when I got, as an entrepreneur, into the telecommunications industry, and through a lot of happen chances and, successfully meeting some great people, having a little bit of, grit, I decided to get into the telecom space. And that opened up Pandora's box for me. You know, went on to start the U.S. prepaid phone card industry with some people out of Mountain View. I grew about a $750 million business, and I started to recognize that everybody somehow or form was connected with some type of a digital currency at that point. That was back in 1989, 1990, and moving forward. I could see the writing on the wall that we were going to be fast and swiftly moving towards new types of species of currencies, particularly with the convergence of the internet and the World Wide Web. And as a funny story, when I started this other company in 2000, or actually 1999, it was called Get To It Commerce Technologies. And I had recruited a gentleman out of Syracuse University to be my chief information officer, which is just a basic term for somebody who that was looking to help kind of predict the future on how commerce was going to be handled. And he was getting his doctorate degree in that. And I said, I believe at some point that this new emerging technology called the World Wide Web is going to be how all banking is done. And funny, he said that. So we started this business, and the technology ended up morphing to what was called the Work Engine. And the reason that we developed this property or this product was because at the time, the internet had used one simple tool to help people navigate the web, and that was called a browser. And a browser was a technology that was developed by the W3C, which is the World Wide Web Consortium, as a standard to help people go from website to website for one basic need, and that was to search and retrieve information. Where we were looking out into the future was commerce, right? How was the commercial application going to be co-joined into this, you know, this search and retrieve community, which really by itself, there was a fault there. There was a problem. And the problem was that the browser is not set up in a secure environment. And for those of you who don't have a technical background, what that meant is that you can't really send money back and forth without those technologies having security applications or protocols attached to them. So this was a little bit before the time when people could just go on Amazon and, you know, buy it, you know, towels or send something as a note to somebody, and these microtransactions were coming, but this is 24, 25 years ago. Anyway, long story short is that technology morphed, and we created this alternative browser called the Work Engine that was based on peer-to-peer, meaning servers talking to each other without the interloping aspect of everybody on the web. And we were using a technology which was, superior at that time, called XML. That has since gone by the wayside, but that business morphed into really becoming one of the first cloud-based application service provider aggregators that was in the beginning of this commercialization of the web, before Bitcoin really was part of anything or digital currency. Even though the banks were already digitizing currency, it had not turned into a unit of exchange at that point. So in my short life, I am 60 years old, but I've seen all these vast changes. And it's amazing to me to think that, I've been able to ride this surfboard, so to speak, across all these different industries that have converged these old species of currencies to these new species of currencies. And now we're seeing some vastly rapid changes happening to us as we speak. So before I bring on Brian, another man, I just want to say a little bit about how this conversation and this radio show, hopefully for all of you out there listening, wherever you are on this great planet of ours, realize that what we're trying to do every single day is make life better for us. And to try to eliminate as much of the interloping and the long arm of the government as possible. I'm not anti-government, but I'm anti getting in my life in every aspect of it. And I'm sure a lot of you are like that too. Like, why do I have to pay a tax when I'm the one that did all the work? Why do I have to pay a tax on a business where I took all the risk? Why do I have to pay a tax on real estate when I'm the one that went out and found the property and filled it with renters? These are all questions that have to do with how the government systems have gotten involved with us in regards to money and banking. And politics is just a wrapper for all this. The government systems itself is all based on business, okay? So we just went through here in the United States another change where we're gonna have a different administrative group of people who are going to try to help bring some more control and power of our own finances and our own wealth, and keeping it, being able to keep all those things for us. So let's jump forward for a second. I got a chance to meet this man about a year and a half ago, and it was because of a trip that I had taken to Colorado. And a really nice gentleman had said, "Kevin, have you heard of this coin? Have you ever heard of Bitcoin?" And yes, I have heard of Bitcoin, but I had not heard of this particular cryptocurrency that he was talking about. And because of my background, this gentleman felt that it was worthy to connect with Brian, who's on the phone or on the radio show with us today. And so we hit it off, and Brian and I spent probably the next 2 or 3 hours going through our past histories. And I was simply aghast and amazed of how intelligent this man is and what he is about to unleash onto this planet as a disruptor and also as a humanitarian, to bring some control back to us as people. And when it comes to, being able to use, banking apparatuses and cryptocurrencies and digital assets to enhance all of our personal portfolios and wealth. So with that said, we're going to take a step forward, and we're going to talk about cryptocurrency as just a species of what it is. For those of you who are new to this topic, don't feel ashamed. At some point, we're probably going to adopt to this anyway, because it's just part of how technology and banking systems merge. And don't be afraid of it. Embrace it. But when you get a chance to listen to Brian's story and then what he's produced, I think you're going to be very excited about the future. So with that said, I'd like to welcome a very special guest and the creator of a special new token that's asset-backed called XUSD. Dr. Brian, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Kevin. I appreciate that.
So great. So thanks, Brian. So let's give these beautiful people all over the world that are listening to us right now a little background maybe about cryptocurrency, a little bit of what, where did you come from? How did you end up with this intellectual space that you could operate from? And what do you see as the future? And then going forward, what do we as a community have to look at in our peripheral vision who are either trying to control more of our wealth or trying to help us gain an advantage in our own lives.
So let's see, where do we start? There's a whole lot of places that we can start.
Let's start off with Bitcoin, since everybody seems to be familiar with Bitcoin.
Yeah, so let's start there. There was a, when we're talking about Bitcoin, as a peer-to-peer electronic cash system, is kind of the original deciding factor, as it were, behind creating this technology. As a decentralized peer-to-peer electronic cash system, in such a way that user one and user two connect to a decentralized network that is distributed across a number of servers. This could be anywhere from two servers to 200. And again, this is all dependent upon how the individual infrastructure is developed. But speaking in regards to Bitcoin, it is a vast number of servers across the individual network. And this allows person one to person two and person two to interact with the network and exchange a modicum of value known as a Bitcoin between party A and party B, peer one, peer two. So that is done through performing that transaction across the network in such a way that completely renders the network kind of as a willing third party to the transaction. The transaction takes place between both peers, and the network actually performs the heavy lifting as far as moving the data from party one to party two. In doing so, what we have found is a completely anonymous and a secure methodology for transmitting wealth between two parties, much like as it would be if you were to take a U.S. dollar in your pocket, walk up to, say, a friend that is selling a widget, a button, a gadget, whatever term that you'd like to use, and you take that dollar out of your pocket and you hand it to your friend, and your friend hands you the widget. That is a one-to-one peer-to-peer transaction. Well, it's the same thing in a digital form with Bitcoin. Is you're performing a one-to-one digitized transaction where you are exchanging one coin to another party, and that other party may give you something, whatever that may be. That's what Bitcoin was originally designed for, as far as what was originally published through Satoshi Nakamoto's, which is a surname, of course, but Satoshi Nakamoto's white paper that was originally published in the early 2000s. Now, we can stretch back a little further than that and look to a white paper that was published in 1996. That white paper was originally published by an individual that at the time was an outside contractor working on behalf of the National Security Agency, where that white paper talked about the use of a distributed computing technology for the purposes of decrypting information, and the ability for the public side of that system to be utilized as a modicum of wealth transfer between individuals, awarded a coin. For instance, miners within that network are awarded coins for the decryption operations that they're done within that network, and then those coins are turned loose into the public market space for individual A to take their fiat currency of choice, convert that into a digital form known as a Bitcoin, and then use that Bitcoin in order to be able to conduct financial transactions on the World Wide Web. So that individual white paper in 1996 kind of laid the framework for it. 2000 and 2001, came along, and Satoshi, the surname Satoshi Nakamoto, writes the Bitcoin, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system, white paper. And then within a matter of months, the Bitcoin network kind of rolled out from there to where we see it. When it originally launched, it launched at about 7 cents a coin, as far as its value was concerned at that point, very early in its release, till we see it today, the over $97,000 per coin, now 16 years later.
Brian, can I just interject for 1 second? Because that's a great background, so people can kind of get their, you know, their heads wrapped around how did this all of a sudden show up? You know, I happen to call it the species of money, because the species of money has changed over the millennia, from gold and silver to, you know, trading furs, coffee, spices. You know, now we have these things called the Federal Reserve Notes, which is a representation of a form of currency, correct? So
yes.
For people who are trying to like decipher in their minds, well, what's the difference between, let's say, a US dollar that I deposit in the bank, Brian, versus a, you know, a unit of cryptocurrency? Because a lot of times people hear, hey, you should have invested in cryptocurrency because I got it at 7 cents and now it's worth $97,000. I mean, look at the money I would have had. People generally don't think of investing their earned money in US dollars, right? Because it's just a form of transfer.
Right.
In fact, it's a depreciating asset, because the more they print, the less value it has. So once I enter that dollar bill, so to speak, into the bank and it becomes a digital unit, what's the difference, Brian, between that digital currency and what you're talking about right now?
Okay. So let's rewind. Okay. Let's see. How's the best way that I can describe this without it going over everyone's head? So let's rewind and give a little bit of history, just kind of to start to talk about systems of currencies, right? 1971, Richard Nixon signed an executive order that ended the convertibility of the U.S. dollar to gold. So effectively removing the United States dollar off of the gold standard. Now, at the time, the price of gold was $35 an ounce. That system that he removed us off of was known as the Bretton Woods system, B-R-E-T-T-O-N-W-O-O-D-S, Bretton Woods system. Now, if you want to do your own research and gain a little bit of understanding, go and do a little Google foo, or using the search engine of your choice. Go in and look up the Bretton Woods system. You'll get a real deep innate understanding as to how currency systems pre-1971 functioned, where most every currency system that we found globally was backed by some sort of gold or precious metal. Now, you must remember, the United States has been considered a superpower. So what happens is what the United States does, every other first world, second world, and third world nation follow. So whatever the United States does per function, those countries follow their lead. In 1971, when the United States was removed from the gold standard, every other country had to follow suit, thus creating what's known as a fiat currency system, where there's no true value backing. So right now, with the United States dollar, gold is no longer held in Fort Knox to back the United States dollar. The United States dollar derives its value based upon what bankers say that its conversion rate to other currencies globally is worth. So is the conversion rate, maybe today, maybe $1.47 to every one Canadian dollar. I'll use that as an example. And again, please understand, that's not exact exchange rate as we're talking. We're just using numbers here for description's sake. But what you have is you have now a group of bankers known as central bankers in the Federal Reserve Bank, the Canadian Reserve Bank, the UK BRICS Bank, or should I say the EU BRICS Bank, which is a central banking institution for the euro, the Royal Bank of London being one of those major banking institutions. There's major central banking institutions globally that interact with one another and determine what the value of the currencies are based upon supply and demand, based upon socioeconomic conditions, based upon inflation. There's multiple factors that go into this. This is what is determinative of our current currency systems as they stand today. When you start talking about digitized systems, such as Bitcoin, right, going back to our initial example, Bitcoin is based upon, and what we call internally at XUSD, what we call them is hot air balloon cryptocurrencies, where these cryptocurrencies are based upon solely on supply and demand. So they're not, there's no, again, just like there was in the original US dollar, where there was gold backing it, and what you had in your pocket was a gold certificate that you could walk into any banking institution and request that your $5 note that you had in your pocket be converted for $5 in gold. Where now, when you're talking about digital currencies, it's just like the United States dollar and many other currencies globally, where it's based upon that supply and demand. So what may be valued today at 7 cents a coin, if there's a high demand, that value may increase to $7 over the course of a week. And that's kind of a very insane proposition to make. But however, that shows the volatility of what a traditional cryptocurrency markets endure today, is a high level of volatility based upon that supply and demand number. And what that rate of trade predicts these markets to grow and predict these markets to grow in such a way. Now, we call them hot air balloon because as the heat is poured on, and when we're talking about heat, we're talking about the demand is poured into it, the value of the coin begins to increase. As the demand falls off, just like in a hot air balloon, when you turn the burner off, the hot air balloon begins to sink because that hot air that was holding it up is now cooling and it's becoming heavier than the surrounding air around it, and it begins to fall. Same thing in a supply and demand style cryptocurrency market. The more demand, the higher the value. As soon as the demand drops off, the value begins to decrease because now people are trying to get out of the market. The more you have selling than you have buying is what creates the decrease in the value. So that's how they compare betwixt the two of them in a fiat system versus a cryptocurrency market in the traditional sense as it stands today.
Awesome. Thank you so much. That's a great explanation. So I would like to share something too, and then this will be great for you to add on to, Brian. In my studies in the last 35 plus years, because, you know, when the phone card kind of came to be, which was an anomaly, it was just one of those things that just the timing was good. Back when people paid for long distance calls, I would look at that storage of time at a server, and I would literally call it virtual telecommunications or virtual currency. You know, this is 25 years ago. And it was based on the value of time and money, right? So a typical long distance call from a credit card in 1989 was like for 1 minute call was over a dollar. And the phone card that we created was like 16 cents. So it was an overwhelming, you know, advantage for people to consider using a prepaid storage system to be able to access their telecurrency than it was for them to use these really heavy end loaded corporate, you know, monolithically heavily weighted down cost created corporations that were delivering a free service called time. So in how I look at time now and money, it's really interesting because all of this is perpetuating so fast. Many need somebody like Brian who makes your brain blow up even more. But the point is that we've had this system that was created by a, you know, international foreign interloper called the Federal Reserve. It's been around since about 1912. It is not an agency of the federal government. It is a private international bank, corporate bank that has nothing to do with the United States. And in 1933, you know, under the Congress's, you know, oppression, we were forced to go off the beginning of the gold standard, and all Americans at that time had to turn in all of their silver notes and all of their gold notes because, as Brian said earlier, our U.S. Treasury was backed by gold and silver, which is a precious metal, right? It's a commodity with limited supply. And that's called lawful money. There's a very big distinction in jurisdiction as it relates to the principles of fiat money versus lawful money.
And real quickly, Kevin, let me interject one thing here when we're talking about the Federal Reserve Bank. Everyone needs to understand the Federal Reserve Bank is a completely independent entity of the United States federal government. That's one thing that most people don't realize. They believe that the Federal Reserve Bank is part and parcel to a U.S. government agency. However, they're really not. They're an independent banking organization with its own board of governors that dictate what happens within that banking institution. The only entity within the United States federal government that has any sort of say, and that say, okay, is very, very limited, is the United States Treasury. And the United States Treasury has if you look at it from a board standpoint, right, if you're going to talk about like a corporate board, right, generally every member of a corporate board, more often than not, has a full vote on that board. The United States Treasury, in this instance, being that the U.S. Treasury does not hold a seat on the board of the Federal Reserve, because they are just a what's known as a consultatory entity to the Federal Reserve Bank in their charter and bylaws, the U.S. Treasury only holds what would be considered a half vote. So even your federal government has no real say at the end of the day as to what happens with the guidance at the Federal Reserve banking level. That's kind of a scary thought when you really think about it. You have a board of governors that are not elected, that are not representative of the people, that cannot be told what to do by the representative government of by the people and for the people in the way that it was originally designed and developed, that they have no say in what happens with our money. An unelected board of bureaucrats on the board of governors of the Federal Reserve Bank dictate what happens with our dollar daily. And our elected representatives have no real say in what happens at Federal Reserve banking level. So something to really think about, how the power of the people has been stripped away from the people by decisions made by those within positions of power within our federal government, beginning really since the Great Depression onward. And to see the detraction from what was considered valuable money by our forefathers and the framers of the United States Constitution, that capability has been stripped away from the people in dictating how, where, and why our money is used and what backs that dollar that you hold in your pocket. That's a really scary proposition.
That's a great point, Brian. And I want to take up very little time here because he has so much to share, but I do want to provide some context to where I was, and we are both going with this. See, most people don't have a grasp of the true history of the United States of America. They have, there's been 6-7 generations since a serious shift that happened in 1871 under the 14th Amendment Act and the Act of 1871. Most people unaware that the United States de jure, the constitutional republic for the United States, was declared bankrupt by the Congress. And at that point, going forward, the International Monetary Fund was created, to our surprise, in 1912, which then became the collection agency for the Federal Reserve that Brian so eloquently talked about. So they, in 1933, had a House Joint Resolution Committee initiative that was a law that essentially subjected all of the U.S. citizens to turn in their treasury notes that were backed by silver. And if they didn't do it, because they were going to replace them with Federal Reserve notes, it was a $10,000 fine, and you could serve up to 10 years in prison. So they forced all of, quote, the people to become subjects in a new jurisdiction based on our bankruptcy that happened. And this was the birth of a private property note called the Federal Reserve. And guess what it was based on, Brian? You know what this is. It was based on the labor of the people. And chattel paper was created called the birth certificate, which was insured by a bond and securities. And now we moved into a securities fiat-based system where the money was simply backed by the labor of the people. And that's how we came up with this term, U.S. citizen, located in Washington, D.C. Okay, so fast forward, because Brian, I want you to really talk about, this is where your intelligence takes hold for me, that what you've done is so innovative and so amazing for disrupting this concept of controlling people by controlling the population of currency and money supply. So how do we get back, everybody? How do we get back to the gold standard? How do we get back to a currency that is based on an asset that has limited supply and tremendous value, such as gold or silver or other types of minerals that are in the treasure of this earth? So what Brian had brought to his attention is that, you know, Bitcoin was a proof of concept and was propped up by the trust of a few people that said, hey, I'll give you 20 bits of this and you give me 20 bits of that, or I'll take a sandwich for this and you give me that. That was proof of concept. People were willing to actually exchange units of a cryptocurrency on a blockchain through essentially a username and a password. So, Brian, let's tell people, what do you see as the future of cryptocurrency? What's going to bring real value back to this gold or silver back concept that we're so wanting?
Well, I'll give a little history first. I was approached by my now partners in December of 2017, and they had this idea. They were working with a lot of the sovereign indigenous tribes in New Zealand, in the Philippines, here in the United States, in Canada as well. And these sovereign indigenous tribes wanted to find a methodology where their store of wealth, which traditionally has been tradable assets, commodities, they wanted to find a non-governmental way of conveying those assets into a system of debits and credits, much like the common law system of debits and credits, where that system would be something that would be beneficial to those sovereign indigenous tribes around the world. And they brought this idea to me, and I had been doing a lot of research and a lot of study at the time into convertible cryptographic systems, much like Bitcoin. Bitcoin had been around now for, at the time, roughly about 5 years. And we kind of had this understanding of, you know, there's got to be a way to do this that kind of limits governmental interaction, but yet doesn't depart from the traditional system. We need a way to be able to incorporate the value that can be added through the traditional banking infrastructure into a cryptocurrency system. EVM blockchains, so Ethereum virtual machine blockchains, I'll stay very helicopter overview here, but the EVM style blockchain was something that had just come into and emerged into the market alongside of Bitcoin. And what the EVM style blockchain allows you to do is have what's known as a, when you start talking about consensus mechanisms, right? Bitcoin is what's known as a proof of work consensus mechanism, meaning that this is why you have to have miners that go and, decrypt this data, decrypt this information in real time to generate a reward known as a Bitcoin. The EVM style blockchains are what's known as a proof of stake consensus mechanism, which means that whomever has the higher amount of coin available within that particular market kind of is the guiding force behind where that market goes, kind of the ebb and sway of that market. And it was a very interesting parallel between the two, where you look at, okay, you have proof of work, and then you have kind of a validator network and proof of stake that decrypts the information transaction to transaction block in such a fashion that secures the overall network as a whole. But it still was just that. It was a hot air balloon type cryptocurrency based upon rate of trade and supply and demand. And we wanted to kind of remove that supply and demand ideal from being what the driving force behind, or the total driving force behind, the markets were. So, and we wanted to be able to incorporate some of these assets that these sovereign indigenous tribes and other asset holders could be able to see a level of profitability off of pledging those assets into this market, and to create something that went far beyond what we were seeing in those markets. As we continued down this road of research, the emergence of what was known as stable coins came into the market, where it was locked against the United States dollar, the value of that coin. So every coin was worth a dollar. Regardless of what the conversion rates were, the value of the coin was always going to be a dollar, because it was set directly against the value of the United States dollar, as imposed by these Federal Reserve banking institutions, these central banking institutions globally. And I kept looking at this and I was going, man, that's the same thing. It's the same thing, just locked against the value of the dollar. It doesn't break away from what the traditional fiat system really is at its core right now. It's the same thing. Nothing's changed. Maybe a different label, a different facade, but it's still at its core, it's a fiat system. It's the same thing. So I started looking into some of the legal framework that what became our legal framework, some of the laws that were surrounding this, like the gold abrogation laws of 1933, the common law system of debits and credits, the United Nations Commission on International Trade Law, the Uniform Commercial Code, and just really started kind of delving deep into these legal frameworks that operate at the core of what traditional finance systems actually are. And I came to this startling realization of, wow, we were really onto something as a society with the Bretton Woods system. The Bretton Woods system really kind of had its prowess within financial frameworks, because this Bretton Woods system, where you're locking against a commodity, the value of the dollar is locked against a commodity, means that whatever happens within that commodity's market is what is determinative of the value of that currency. So it made sense that, well, let's rewind back to the Bretton Woods system, but let's give it a little bit more of stability that's required within traditional markets. Because, of course, with what was done in 1971 by Nixon and removing us off of the gold standard, everyone knew there was going to be a run on the gold markets. It was kind of plain to see that was going to be happening. And what the fear was at the time was that, really, you know, if there was a run on gold markets and the value of gold there in 1971, which was $35 an ounce, artificially depressed, mind you, the value of gold was being artificially manipulated, in my opinion. And you can go back and look at the commodities markets from August of 1971, and you can see where there was an upward swing, and then all of a sudden it levels off because there was currency controls that were being put in place by the United States Treasury, where they were going in and buying into commodities markets, and doing that in that way became a big issue.
So, Brian, here's where I see things happening alongside of what you're doing. My prediction is that what Brian and his team and others that are doing right now is that we're moving a rapid push towards asset-backed cryptocurrencies, lawful money, gold and silver actually backing these tokens and crypto. Most of the thirst for crypto right now is based on acquiring the coins to watch them inflate, right? Because people like instant millionaires who had Bitcoin, they didn't even know they had it. All of a sudden, oh my gosh, I opened up my wallet and, you know, now I have $850,000 and I paid $4,000 for that, you know, 8 years ago. That is the insatiable appetite of the individual who wants to earn wealth. It's like an accidental investment. So right. We're going to go ahead.
Right. That's correct.
So as we move through this phase of adoption, because we're in the early adopter phase, you know, overall the world is still de minimis in terms of adoption, right? People are just now starting to catch on to this is not going to go away. But ironically, the even Bitcoin as itself, even though it doesn't have a central headquarters, there's no CEO, there's no management team, it is essentially a self-contained operating system based on hash power and networks scattered throughout the world, right? For that proof of stake that Brian was talking about.
Yeah.
But the thing is that you can use Bitcoin today to buy an airline ticket. You could use Bitcoin to, let's say, you know, buy some food at a restaurant. And I think the current president that's coming in was at a burger stand in New York City, and he showed, hey, I'm going to be able to buy everybody a burger with my, you know, my mobile phone, and he used his cryptocurrency to purchase. That was proof that now the head of these big government corporations essentially are saying the future of cryptocurrency is here. And where I predict this is that, you know, as what
let me step in and let me say this. It's not that the future of cryptocurrency is here, but where now it's that's proven that cryptocurrency has a value within the traditional system. That just showed that to merchants, merchants have the ability to use instantaneous real-time modicum of transfer of wealth between a merchant and an individual and a buyer and a consumer. So that just proved that that capability of transferring value from party A to party B or consumer to merchant, it was absolutely salient within our current system of technologies. So, you know, that was a huge proof of concept in that to show that cryptocurrencies are valid in today's traditional market space. And we've seen that going forward. Through Bitcoin, we've seen large Bitcoin transactions done to purchase homes. We've seen large USDT Tether transactions being used to purchase cars and, purchase plane tickets and these sort of things. So we know that this is something that's possible to be done within markets. But again, these same systems, right? Bitcoin, USDT Tether, Ethereum, Polygon, these are all hot air balloons. They're all based upon that supply and demand. We felt like we needed to make a major change. So what we did is one of my partners runs a large trust that works with these sovereign indigenous tribes and starting with them and going into the traditional private sector asset classes. What we turned around and did was develop a large pool of assets, have individuals take their assets, pledge them into this pool, and use that pool of assets spread across a vast number. We're talking 20 plus commodities marketplaces, and put those into a pool, take that pool of assets and use that pool of assets to back the value behind a cryptocurrency. Now, the reason we're spread across so many commodities marketplaces is to do the one thing that the Brentwood Standard couldn't hedge against, right? Which is a run on a market. The Brentwood Standard and the Brentwood system in August of 1971, when Richard Nixon stepped us back from the gold standard, knowing that this run on gold was coming and with there being a huge fear of inflation in that time, between 1944 and 1971, knowing that this was coming, they felt like we had to remove just from the gold standard. And what we believed in developing our cryptocurrency, which is XUSD Prime 2 and XUSD blockchain, the new blockchain that we're coming out with, what we believed is, well, let's just take the Brentwood standard and put it on steroids. Let's take, instead of just gold backing the currency, let's use a plethora of commodities, precious metals, gold, silver, platinum, palladium, gemstones and rubies and diamond and emerald, sapphire, so on and so on, at the industrial level and at the numismatist level. And, you know, let's take exotic metals. You know, you're talking about lithium, you're talking about, you know, copper isotope, you're talking about, you know, of course, the precious metal sides, but then you're talking about crude oil, you're talking about natural gas, you're talking about exotic gases such as hydrogen, exotic chemical bases such as deuterium, which is known as heavy water, which is used in the production of nuclear energy. Taking all of these assets, which all have their own intrinsic value, and placing those assets into a pool, and then using that pool of assets to back the coin itself, thus mitigating a lot of the giant swing in price volatility that might come in traditional commodities markets. By spreading that load out across all of those commodities markets, you do the one thing that the Bretton Woods system was incapable of doing, which was mitigating that opportunity for there to be inflation. Now, if this would have, if this foresight would have been seen by those in positions of power here in the United States, I don't believe we would have departed from the Bretton Woods system. I believe the Bretton Woods system would have been modified to do exactly what we're doing now with XUSD, which is to provide a diverse asset backing behind our system of debits and credits, our fiat, what now is fiat currency, but our greenbacks, our U.S. dollar that was backed by then gold, and spreading that out into silver and other precious metals. I think we could have eliminated this scare that there was on a run happening on gold markets. So we decided to do what should have been done in 1971 and bring it forward. You know, this is why we talk about XUSD being a 21st century digital asset, holding a 20th century value, providing 23rd century capability, because what we believe is that this will be the wave of the future. We believe that what we've created in doing this as being the model for what all other cryptocurrencies going forward in the future are going to be required by regulatory to follow. There's a lot of new regulatory things that are happening, and we can get into that in later episodes and talk about this further. But with all of this new regulatory that may be piling in, we now have this beacon of hope for cryptocurrency markets that's kind of pointed itself, you know, and made itself very clear with the election of the second election as the 47th president of the United States, with Donald John Trump becoming the president of the United States, and the people that he is putting in place. What we're about to see in the United States is the first pro-cryptocurrency administration in the history of the United States. That's a big deal, because now what you're talking about is now you finally have somebody at a governmental level, in any government globally, you have somebody at a governmental level that's saying cryptocurrency is here to stay, and it has value for people, and it has value for government to be involved. Now, that's a big deal. And for someone to kind of make that statement, even though that statement may not have been put out there so eloquently and verbally by this administration, you can point to the individuals that this administration is starting to propose and look towards being confirmed, individuals in certain departmental positions within the United States government that have always held such a pro-crypto stance. And that's an important thing to keep in mind, that crypto's here to stay. It's not going away. And now that you have members of U.S. government saying that it is here to stay, it is important for not only traditional markets, but it's important for anti-inflationary measures for the United States to have an involvement in cryptocurrency. Now this stands to reason that every other first world nation is going to follow suit behind the United States to whatever new regulatory positions are taken by the United States. All these other global first world governments are going to come to the table and match standard with the United States, because the United States has been the one who write the standard for finance globally for the last 100 years.
So, Brian, I just want to answer a couple of questions for some people that are probably listening in about this. Everybody's worried about the, quote, one world currency, and I know we don't have a whole lot more time, but I just want to touch on this because what you represent, what you present, formation, is a private sector innovative entrepreneur and a group of thought leaders and people who are bringing all of their levels of expertise and all these indices that are cooperating in this world of finance, commodities, you know, stocks, bonds. The smaller guy, the average American or people out there in the world, they don't feel like they have any advantage anymore because artificial intelligence seems to be taking some kind of monumental leap forward. And people aren't going to be able to actually compete with this massive technology that is trying to keep an extreme unfair advantage over, you know, the everyday person that's just working. So maybe you can do this, but I just want to let everybody know you have hope. You have the promise of the future. You have something to look forward to because are people like Brian right now that are doing this. And then I want you just to share a little bit of, you know, how can people find out more about XUSD? And then what do you have in terms of contracts that is supporting this initiative of actually true asset-backed cryptocurrency coming into our community soon?
Absolutely. And let me add on to what you just said now. Ladies and gentlemen, the one world currency has been here since August of 1971. You have to remember something. Every single nation in the world buys and sells commodities, gold, silver, platinum, palladium, crude oil, gasolines, diesel fuels, all of these things. Guess what? It's all priced in the US dollar. The US dollar has been the one world cryptocurrency really since 1944, if we're going to be real about it. So the United States dollar has been the one world currency as it stands. Cryptocurrency is not the emergence of a one world currency. Now, cryptocurrency gives us a lot of things. It gives us security. It gives us transaction or can give us transactional value through our innovation with XUSD, and has the ability to provide a peer-to-peer methodology, kind of removing the banking system out of the loop where you don't have to worry about going to a bank to place dollars into a bank to then send it through a wire transfer to someone else. You can now operate one-to-one where you can just go to Bob who's selling a bicycle and pay Bob directly without having to worry about a bank being in the middle or a merchant system or a merchant account being involved there. Now, individual to individual can purchase anything. That's kind of the emergence of what cryptocurrency has. And really, it's the security mindset behind that of being able to secure the transaction above and beyond of what we're traditionally used to using, which is the system of debit cards and credit cards. Remember, digital currency has been a thing from the very beginning with the emergence of the debit card. Why? Well, because it's just ones and zeros that are passing from your account at bank A to the merchant's account at bank B. The actual physical currency never really moves from bank A to bank B. It's just done in ones and zeros on paper and ledgered from account to account. So digital currency has always been here. What we're trying to endeavor to do with XUSD is to show that you can do this in a much more secure way, still utilizing the overall infrastructure that already exists, but you can do this in a secure way, removing the opportunity for bad actors, the bad guys, if you will, stealing credit card numbers and debit card numbers and stealing your identity in your bank account, and be able to protect that modicum of transfer of your wealth from party A to party B. Now, if you want to find out more about what we're doing, you can check us out on the web. We're still in process of finalizing and building our website, but there's a lot of great information that's there. Some really great blog posts that we have up there now at xusd.co. That's XUSD. So I'll spell this phonetically for you. X as in X-ray, U as an umbrella, S as in Sierra, D as in Delta, .co or .charlieoscar.co, XUSD.co. You can download our white paper right off of the front page. And also our patents. Now, I want to make this point known. As far as we know, okay, and in the research that we've done, XUSD is the first cryptocurrency of its kind to be asset-backed and is the first cryptocurrency of its kind to have international patent backing. We're the only, to our knowledge, the only cryptocurrency to have a full U.S. patent that has been approved. We have 11 additional patents that are patent pending right now, and that's what kind of gives us the leverage above everything. As far as assets in our pool are concerned, we have one mine alone that's valued in the trillions of dollars. We have one deuterium holding that is well over $1 trillion in value. So what I'll say is this, we haven't publicized since our new audit the value of our current pool, but I'll say it like this. The value of our pool far exceeds that of the United States national debt. I'll say it like that. That's a good way to describe it. If you don't know what the U.S. national debt is, go look up in the search engine of your choice, the U.S. debt clock. That'll tell you exactly where our U.S. debt stands as it is today and the value of that. So, you know, we're endeavoring to do some brilliant things as far as innovation in blockchain, things that we were told when we originally jumped into this project were impossible. We've brought the impossible into reality. So awesome. That said, you go check us out on the web, and we'd love to hear from you, and we'd love to answer as many questions as we can going forward. And you know, Kevin's kind of extended the opportunity for us to do multiple shows here going forward and talking about this and getting more in deep into what cryptocurrencies have to offer to the general public. So I'm really looking forward to it, Kevin. Thanks for this opportunity, by the way.
You're sure welcome, Brian. Let's keep this rolling. Thank you so much. We're going to wrap up this show. Thank you, everybody, for wherever you are standing, laying down, sitting, you know, looking out. Just know this, In God You Trust is all about you trusting yourself and about, you know, living to the best of your ability. We are here to share, you know, human experiences, yet still talking and working through this concept of finance and how we can all have some kind of an advantage in a very disadvantaged system. Don't let anybody bring you down. Think about who you are, what you want to be. This is the beginning of your life starting today. We are so grateful to be here on BBS Radio. Thank you so much for tuning in. Until next time, we'll see you the following week at the same time, same place, ingodyoutrust.org, ingodyoutrust.org. If you wish to learn about structuring your estate and how you can shelter those taxes and protect yourself going forward, I encourage you to go to that. Thank you so much, everybody. We look forward to seeing you soon. Thank you much for joining us. God bless. Talk to you later.